Welcome to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, recovery coach professional. Do you love food, alcohol, drugs, sex, social media, cigarettes, or gambling a little too much? The traditional narrative says that addiction to these vices is the problem. The truth is, they are just symptoms. This hit show takes you from recovery to your ultimate life as my special guests and I help you discover how underneath every vice is the addiction to the suffering that developed due to unhealed trauma. So what can you do? Hungry for Answers provides groundbreaking, proven solutions from my best-selling spiritual book, Feast and Famine, Healing Addiction with Grace. It's time to stop suffering and start living your ultimate life. You have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. Hungry for Answers starts now. Hello, everyone. It's Robin Clare, and welcome to Hungry for Answers. Today is a very interesting show for me. It's actually one of two episodes we're doing. We're doing part one today, and you'll be able to listen to part two on July 15th. And the reason why this is so special to me is because this is two shows about what I struggled with addiction and how I had to come into recovery. So this show and the show on July 15th is about food disorders and why they're a hidden epidemic. And what's so interesting is that there are 30 million people that struggle with food disorders, food addiction in the United States, and two-thirds of them are women. And so I know for sure about the hidden aspect of it. I hid for years with bulimia, and I think anybody who is bulimic hides in the bathroom. And so it's really an important topic. And that's why I'm so glad that I have Dr. Susan Averna with me. She's my friend and colleague, and she's a developmental psychologist, a yoga teacher, an addiction researcher, and also someone who has recovered from an eating disorder. So I thought, what a better person to spend two episodes with me. So I'd like to welcome Susan to the show. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Robin. Hi to all your listeners. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you're welcome. So Susan, can you describe a time in your life where you were so hungry for answers that you didn't think that you'd ever be able to get the answer that you need?
I can think of two different aspects to that question. So the first one is the topic here today. When I was first getting into the disordered eating, initially I didn't think it was a problem, but a few years in, I started realizing I'm in something that I have no idea how to get out of. And I really thought at that point that I was going to be doing this for the rest of my life because I really could not see a way out. And I remember praying and studying and searching in every avenue I could think of for answers. So that's the first, and I did find them. So that's the good news, and we'll be getting to that. But and then the other area is I have suffered my whole life with chronic pain. And well, beginning as young as seven, is as early as I remember, but and that's been a lifelong evolution. So I've gotten some answers and I'm still seeking answers, not necessarily from the medical community anymore, but more spiritual in that nature. And so, yeah, those two things together have been a big search for me.
And do you think there was any way that they were interrelated at the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, we can get into this now or later, but I agree with you completely that underlying most, if not all, addiction is trauma. And I do think that the same trauma that was underlying the eating is also underlying the pain. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, as I recovered from the eating, which was 15 years ago now, the pain actually amplified. And it's now gotten better. It's taken me some time, but it sort of came in, I think, as a, I don't know, that the something wasn't totally resolved under there. And so...
Yeah. Yeah. And so we had spent a whole episode on pain. Mm. Can it be a gift with Barry
Anyhow.
Grant? I think so. How about
it
in your
has
life?
Been. It certainly has prompted and continues to fuel my spiritual evolution I don't know that I would have explored or even shifted my beliefs the way I have over the last 30, 40 years if it weren't for the pain. So I do see it that way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's something you said earlier that you said to me before, and even challenges the name of the show a little bit, which is Eating Disorders, the Hidden mm-hmm. Dilemma. And you refer to them as disordered eating yes. versus eating disorders. And I'm wondering if there's something, if there's a difference in the meaning, or it's just maybe your, you know, psychological background training that would call it disordered eating.
Not that it's different so much, it's that I feel like disordered eating encompasses a bigger range of what we see people doing. So when I think of eating disorders, I think of it in the way that the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, defines it. So that's the sort of book that psychiatrists and the medical community typically use here in the US. And they have very specific criteria and very specific names for different ways of eating, of disordered eating. But you could have, in my opinion, you could not meet those criteria completely and maybe not get that full diagnosis and still be disordered in your eating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all eat in ways that are not just for pure hunger and pure fueling our body. That's normal. And I'm not even calling that disordered. That would, to me, would be more like emotional eating. So, you know, when we eat because we're bored, or we eat because we're a little stressed, or we're distracting ourselves and we're procrastinating, there's all kinds of reasons why we use food other than pure physical hunger and fuel. And that's not necessarily disordered, but it could be. It's a slippery slope. It can morph into that when we really start to use it as a crutch. And when it starts to interfere with the quality of our life, if it's interfering with your health, mental or physical, if it's interfering with your relationships or your work, your ability to work, or just to do what you want to do, that's when I would say it's becoming disordered. And it may not have fully met the criteria of an eating disorder, which we can talk about if you'd like those specific diagnoses.
Yeah, and I found too, even in my journey with obsessive compulsive food disorder, it would really all begin with what did I have for breakfast? Mm. Like if I had something that I perceived as healthy for breakfast or good, then I had a chance for the rest of the day to eat like in a normal, healthy way. If I ate something that I perceived as unhealthy or bad, then the rest of the day was just, you know, what can I eat next? And it became this journey of obsessively eating. And then if I felt really bad about myself, then it would move to bulimia.
Yeah.
And then even if it didn't move to bulimia, I would still feel terrible at the end of the day and the next morning. I describe in my book, Feast and Famine, about how I had this ritual every night and every morning of grabbing my belly to see how big it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that's all part of the disordered eating, because once I felt out of order in my eating, then the rest of the day would be like, what's going to happen next?
Yeah. And that's a beautiful illustration of what I was saying about how, when it begins to interfere with your quality of life. And so one of the hallmarks of these disorders is when you start to set rules and your thinking becomes distorted around food. So foods are good and bad. You know, you eat certain things and not others, or maybe there's a certain amount or certain time of day, whatever it is, you have your rules. And so you sort of just show that if you followed your rule, if whatever you ate for breakfast fell within the range that you were comfortable, given that rigid sort of criteria that you've set for yourself, then you felt okay. And then if you veer from that, and we all veer from that, because the stricter the rules, you're basically setting yourself up, right? And so you're going to veer from that. And then it's all the sequelae that comes after that. And, you know, we don't have to jump into sort of treatment yet, but unraveling that really is to interrupt that process, that sort of, it's just feeding on itself. You know, you're harsher on yourself, and you're stricter on yourself, and you're harsher, and it can really snowball easily into more and more problematic behavior, where, such as maybe now you're compensating by vomiting or whatever those other behaviors when they follow.
Yeah. So we've mentioned eating disorder, uh-huh. disordered eating. Let's uh-huh. jump into what are the most common forms of eating disorders that okay. maybe people would be most familiar with.
Yeah, the ones that probably people have heard about and that are most diagnosed, aside from feeding disorders in infancy, we're not going to talk about that so much, but more about what we see in teens, young adults, adulthood. The first one being anorexia or anorexia nervosa. And that is where you see a very big restriction of food intake that results in significant weight loss or lack of weight gain if the person is growing and should be gaining. That's sort of the criteria that's used. But again, what you see with that is a lot of these rigid rules and cognitive distortions around body image. Thinking that they're fat when they're not, that kind of thing. Again, making foods good or bad, right or wrong, that kind of thing. The other one that is probably talked about the most, and you mentioned it already, is bulimia nervosa. And that's a little bit different in that the person also has the same body image issues. And we can go into what may be really underlying this, but I'm talking about just the actual criteria for the disorder. In this case, they're binging. And so defining a binge is sort of in a discrete amount of time, consuming a very large amount of food. I don't think this part's in the DSM, but I know that typically that food is easily ingested. It's usually highly caloric and maybe full of sugar and things that are, we can talk about later, how physiologically that makes you feel better in the short term. But right. then there is a lot of guilt, remorse, fear, anxiety that comes with having done that. And from there, there's this desire to undo it or get rid of it. And so there's always a compensatory behavior that follows. And mm-hmm. most people think of that as purging through vomiting, which is very common. That is one way that people do this. But it's not the only way. People may use laxatives. They may fast and really restrict to compensate. Right. They may right. overexercise. So all of those things are compensatory behaviors. And again, it gets into a loop because one feeds the other. Yes. There are studies that show, for instance, that if you take quote unquote normal people who do not have any eating issues and you restrict their food intake, they will binge. It's just our bodies are set up to do that. It's a survival mechanism.
Right.
So it's really difficult when you start to get into that loop to break it just mm-hmm. because they feed on each other. And then the third disorder that is now recognized and has been recognized for some time is binge eating disorder. And similar to bulimia, there's the binge aspect. And the binging is, it's not really willful. Neither is it in bulimia. It's really a way of self-soothing. But the person is consuming a large amount of food in a short period of time. It just doesn't have the compensatory component to it. But it is still really an attempt at helping oneself feel better. So those are the three that are most common.
Yeah, so we're going to be going into a break in just a minute or so. And what I'd like to talk about when we return from the break is, if you think, Susan, do you think of food disorders as addictive behavior? Mm-hmm. And does society recognize food disorders as a form of addiction? So we'll be returning soon. Stay tuned, everybody. You're listening to Hungry for Answers with Robin Clare and my guest, Susan Averna, and we'll be right back.
The truth is funny. Shift happens with monthly guest host Karen Benton. Tune in for powerful conversations about health and wellness. Karen brings unique insights rich with humor and science to her discussions with experts in medicine, movement, psychology, spirituality, and so much more. Don't miss Karen on The Truth Is Funny every third Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information about Karen, visit KarenBenton.com.
Tune into Hungry for Answers every first and third Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com with me, Robin Clare. I am a recovery coach, professional, and best-selling author, bringing you eye-opening conversations about addiction and groundbreaking tools for recovery. To learn about me and my offerings, visit clarity.com. That's Claire, C-L-A-R-E-I-T-Y.com.
Are you ready to experience full body system wellness? Tune in to the Empower Me Show with Pam Bright, a spiritual toolbox for your life. Embrace the fullness of who you are as a spiritual being, having a human experience. Pam Bright is a multidimensional healer, light language channel, energy intuitive, and spiritual transformation coach. Join her for a rich conversation about how to unlock all your spiritual gifts. Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio.
We figured by the time we turned 50, we kind of had life figured out, but we were not prepared for the realities of midlife. Tune in to And That's When I Realized, the truth and comedy of midlife with me, Susan Dolce.
And me, Leon Dyer, every second and fourth Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You're not alone in these challenges, and sometimes you just gotta laugh.
Find us at SusanDolce.com
and LeonDyer.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare. To learn more about me or my offerings, please go to clarity.com. That's C-L-A-R-E-I-T-Y.com. And I'm here with Dr. Susan Averna. And Susan, how can people reach you if they'd like to talk to you more about this topic?
They can reach me through my Facebook page, which is called Witness and Wonder. And they can also email me at Susan Averna, S-U-S-A-N-A-V-E-R-N-A, at Comcast.net.
That's great. So before we went to break, we were talking about this idea, or we wanted to discuss, are food disorders considered food addiction? And does society recognize food disorders as a form of addiction? And I just want to say, before you even answer, when I was, you know, doing a lot of research for my own healing process, and or when I would say to people, I'm an addict, and they'd be like, that's not an addiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And I remember my brother, Michael, had a form of addiction, and we would argue over whose was worse. Or he'd be like, because yours doesn't even count. And I'm like, yes, it does. Yes, it does. And so so I think we're better than we were mm-hmm. around recognizing mm-hmm. disordered eating as a form of addiction, and the all of that, the binging and the purging, the sugar. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, sugar, like huge addiction in this country, right? And we also saw just we'll get in, maybe get into this later, but part of the reason why I wanted to do this is because there have been so many headlines that during COVID-19, the increase in food disorders went off the charts. Yeah. And, you know, we know there are a lot of reasons for that. We were lonely. We were bored. We were scared. Yeah. You name it. You know, nobody was watching, right? Like you were home alone. Like I can come up with 10 reasons why food disorders. But let's just get to the question.
Yeah.
Is food disorder a form of addiction?
Well, I can understand why you were not able to really find much on that, because if you look at the information provided by the American Psychiatric Association or the American Psychological Association, they define addiction, or actually, I don't even know that they use that word as much anymore, but if you're looking at a particular substance, they might say alcohol dependence, or the dependence or abuse of a certain substance. They have very specific criteria, and that is building a tolerance and withdrawal. And so, you know, when you're, for instance, if you're a drinker, you need more and more and more of that substance to get the same high. That's the tolerance. And the withdrawal is the physiological experience that happens, the awful experience when you stop. So that doesn't translate quite as neatly over to eating disorders, although I guess we could probably argue that there is some of that. But
especially with the sugar.
Yeah, absolutely, with the sugar. And that's what I was getting at when I was saying with binging. Typically, people don't binge on steak and salad. They're binging on ice cream and cookies and things that are easily to digest, and they give you a quick high. And you know, sugar does provide a it's a painkiller, you know. So even if you're not aware that that's what you're doing, your body's aware that that's what you're doing. And I do want to get into that in a second too, about how biologically driven this behavior is and how we really need to let ourselves off the hook. This is not a moral failing or weakness. Your body is knowing what you need, and it's doing its best in the context of where you are to get that need met. But back to your question. When you more broadly define addiction and you look at it in terms of craving, in terms of control or being out of control, the compulsions or the need to engage in certain behaviors, you see that across all kinds of addictive behavior. That certainly qualifies. Those are huge pieces of being in the middle of an eating disorder. So in that way, yes, I absolutely think that it is an addiction. So again, it's maybe how you define it. I think your other question was, does society at large?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, so much of our information comes from the media, so it depends on how the media is portraying this. And people tend to really harp on the observable behaviors and sort of the obvious behaviors. So when you talk about eating disorders, you look at people's bodies, their weight, what they're eating, how much they're eating, whether they can stop eating. And when you look at it that way, it doesn't look so much maybe as certain other disorders do. I guess, well, maybe it does, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Certainly, we accept that people can be addicted to substances. We accept that people can be addicted to gambling behaviors, shopping, sex.
Right.
So there's really no reason not to think that we could be addicted in this way. But all of those other behaviors are, in theory, optional. Not for the addict. It doesn't feel optional at all in the moment.
Right.
But in theory, they could all stop those behaviors. We cannot stop eating. We have to create a new relationship with food. So that's another thing that I think takes it away from lumping it together. But if you begin to strip back what is driving the behavior, to me, the eating is just an outcome. It's one possible outcome. You and I, with our histories, and I don't even know your whole history, but whatever it was that was making you suffer, that then led to this way of soothing and meeting a need, it for you manifested in food. It for your brother manifested differently. It could have just as easily for me manifested in alcohol or substance use or some other addictive behavior. But if we get to my story, you'll see why it came out in food. And so when you look at the commonalities driving addictive behavior, then it's really easy to see. It's all the same thing. It's just a different outcome.
Yeah.
On the surface.
On the surface, right. So let's talk about your story. You know, briefly share with everybody what your food disorder story is.
Yeah. I'll say that it's complicated and there's a lot of factors. And if we could take a minute to sort of talk through those, I think that would be useful, because what I want people to understand is an eating disorder or any addictive behavior is multifactorial. So there's no one thing. It's not like you have this gene and there and that, therefore you have this outcome, or you had this one experience and therefore you have an outcome. There's multiple factors that come into play, and there's things that happen maybe in your early experience, maybe in the family or in your other environment. There's your own personal temperament, personality characteristics. There probably are genetic propensities that are passed down intergenerationally. There's all of these things. And then there might also be triggering events. But you have to sort of take in the whole, because without taking in the whole, you can't treat it, because you can't just treat the sort of surface, what it looks like. You have to go back to those core things. So for me, let me paint the backdrop for you. Mm-hmm. I did not have eating issues when I was a child or adolescent. I didn't think about it. Anything I wanted, whenever I wanted. In fact, I ate tons of junk food, guilt-free, and I didn't have a weight issue or anything. So that was working in my favor. But what wasn't working in my favor is I was a highly anxious kid, and I come from a anxiety disordered family. Not diagnosed for the most part, but you know, there's a lot of that in my history, in my lineage, as well as in my immediate family. And I already told you I had pain, which I did not know until maybe high school was not normal. I just thought everybody hurt the way I did, but I came to realize that was not true. So that's there. My dad was alcohol dependent. And since before I was born, I don't know when his struggle started. But so that was sort of shaping our family. And there was a lot of unpredictability and anxiety around that. When I was in high school, he very unexpectedly passed away due to alcohol complications. And so that was both a traumatic event, but it was also the culmination of a lot of other strife along the way. And because of the nature of our family, we didn't talk about it. I didn't go to a therapist. There was no outlet or resolution of that. So I was carrying that as well. So, and I also had body image issues, like a lot of young girls and boys do. And so I didn't have the eating stuff and the weight stuff so much, but I didn't like how I looked. And, you know, I had a lot of self-consciousness around that. So all that swirling around. And then I go off to college, and that's already sort of anxiety provoking and new territory. And I gain some weight like a lot of freshmen do, the freshman 15, because now I'm still eating anything I want, except I'm not growing anymore. So I'm starting to gain some weight, and I'm not that worried about it at first.
Yeah.
But then there was one more incident that I'm sure played a role. There was a sexual assault. I was sexually assaulted as a freshman. And again, didn't talk about it. Didn't see a therapist, didn't tell my family. So all of this is building, and I was in a lot of pain. I had debilitating headaches at this point. And, you know, I kind of just muddled through my freshman year. And when I came home, I was a wreck, just full of anxiety. I really didn't like how I looked or felt, because at that point I had gained 15 or 20 pounds. And except I look back at pictures now and I go, you're kind of cute. But at the time, you know, I didn't like what I looked like.
So, and I just want to interject for a moment that your story sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
Like, it is.
I imagine there's so many listeners here that are saying, oh yeah, the app. Yes, I gained that weight. I was sexually assaulted, because we know through the Me Too movement that we've all been sexually assaulted, most women. And I always say, if you have not been sexually assaulted, you're probably in denial.
I don't know.
I think that's why it blew up the way that it did.
I think you're right.
But you know, getting back to your story, I just want people to take a moment and say, you know, here's where we're at. And in regards to food addiction, I was shared by my guidance this hashtag instead of Me Too. Who me, capital H, capital small U, capital M, capital small E, which was this epidemic of humiliation that so many of us face, which can also add to our eating disorder. So we have like a minute or so left before our next break. Would you like to share the rest of your story?
I think I could share it fairly quickly, but I do want to say, let's definitely get back to the humiliation and shame, because that's a huge component. So the bottom line was this: I wanted to lose some weight. It was the late 80s. It was the fat makes you fat culture. And I just started restricting anything that had fat in it. And that is, you know, I fell into that sort of rigid rulemaking, and it was successful. I lost all the weight and then some, and I went back to college the next year and, oh, Sue, you look so great. And that is very double-edged, because while you love hearing it, the backside of that is, but you didn't before. Or, you know, so it's very conditional, and so it keeps driving it, and it just kept going. And it took several years before it really took hold. I wasn't binging at that point or anything, But as I got, you know, into sort of other anxiety provoking situations, like graduating from college and figuring out what to do with my life, at that point, yeah, I started to, the overeating led to a binge, led to more restricting, and then got into that cycle. My 20s were just awful.
Yeah.
Just terrible. And I'm not even sure how I did graduate degrees and working all the jobs I did. And because it's an energy drain, as you know, it just really takes over your life.
But I would also say, Susan, before we go to break, that there are so many women and men who are struggling with eating disorders, but having a very successful life like we.
Oh,
we
I are. Looked great on the outside. People yes. thought I was just yes. very high achieving That's- and had this easy, must life must come so easy for you. And I thought, oh God, that is not the truth.
Yeah, and that's why part of why I call it a hidden epidemic. So we're going to go to break.
Okay.
And you're listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and my guest, Dr. Susan Averna, and we'll be right back.
Did you know that when we talk about the Earth's ecosystems, the most important ecosystem has been left out? You. We created the ecosystem approach to recapture human potential.
Find us at theecosystemapproach.org.
Join us every Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 4 p.m. Eastern Time for the Ecosystem Approach Show with Jason and Patricia on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Are you feeling the complexity of life? Do you feel that urge to step into something greater? Tune in to Nailed It Radio. Find your simplicity within your complexity with me, life coach, Carrie Nail. Tune in each month on TransformationTalkRadio.com to discover what it means to use your full power to be the best version of yourself. Imagine stepping into the energy of saying yes to yourself and knowing you nailed it. For more information about me, visit CarrieNail.com.
Juggling life's relentless demands can leave us unbalanced and restless. Do you feel stuck in the overwhelm? Diane McClay is a personal empowerment coach, author, and compassionate storyteller on a mission to boost you into balance and help you move forward with passion and purpose. Get unstuck with Diane on The Diane McClay Show every second and fourth Friday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information about Diane, visit DianeMcClay.com.
Grace your space with flair. Dragon Art to Soothe Your Soul by Colette Marie Steffen is available now. Colette invested an average of 6 months on each painting. Her piece titled Courage took 3 years to complete. The paintings are printed with the latest technology to best capture the true essence of the paintings. Browse the 64 dragons and dragonflies and order your paintings today at talesfromthevector.com.
Hello and welcome back to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare. To learn more about me and my offerings, please go to clarity.com. That's clarity.com. And I'm here with Dr. Susan Averna. And Susan, could you just share with everybody how they can reach you?
Yes, they could reach me through my Facebook page called Witness and Wonder, and also through email at susanaverna@comcast.net.
Thank you. So, you know, in the first two segments of the show, you might have been recognizing a little bit of yourself or recognizing these attributes or traits in people that you love. And so my next question to Susan is, how do you recognize an eating disorder in yourself or in someone that you love?
In yourself, I think that eating disorders are so insidious, they kind of sneak up on us. Mm-hmm. And so it may not get recognized in the early stages, which is unfortunate because that's the best time to kind of change course. But if you start to notice that the rules that you've set for yourself are so restrictive that they're really interfering with the joy of living your life, or you are, in my case, I can remember turning down invitations to go out to dinner or to be social because I was afraid to spin out of control if I wasn't able to control the food or the situation. If there's any way in which the food now is making choices for you rather than the other way around, that's a pretty big indicator that this has gotten beyond just some dieting or, a little bit of a lifestyle choice. It's really beginning to run your life.
I think food is, I agree with you, it's so sneaky. And we have so much permission to eat. We even have so much, at holidays, we can eat whatever we want. It's like, oh, it's Thanksgiving. Great. I have till after New Year's to think about controlling what I'm eating, right? I remember once being on a diet plan a long time ago, and it was brilliant. They gave you a calendar and they said, put an X in every day that you think it's okay to eat whatever you want. Whatever. And by the time we got done with weekends, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, parties, whatever it was, by the time we got done, there were just a few days where in a given month where you could focus on, being in a healthy lifestyle. That was very eye-opening to me. But so why do you think that people struggle with body image and food?
I don't want to blame it only on the culture, because as I mentioned before, there really is a perfect storm of factors that come together to create a full-blown eating disorder. But we are being set up. I mean, the standards in our culture for what our bodies should look like, and the fact that they need to look a certain way at all is the first piece. It's like our bodies are not for someone else's viewing pleasure, therefore moving ourselves around in this world and doing the good we want to do in this world. But we're from a very early age, we're not getting that message. We're supposed to look a certain way, whatever that is for the culture that you're in. And then of course now the impossible standards. I mean, this has been talked about, written about for decades, but it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. And not just for girls, but boys too. And that's why you're seeing the rise in boys. It's just these unattainable standards. And the only way you can do that is to be dysfunctional and not really intuitively do what your body is asking for. If you want to create a particular shape or weight and it's not natural to you, then you're going to have to do some pretty unnatural things. And with the rise of social media too, thank goodness that was not around when I was a teenager. I don't even want to think about the trajectory I could have taken. But, our young kids and teens and young adults, I teach college students and they talk about just how they scroll through Instagram and compare themselves and how awful they feel after doing that. And I know I do that to some degree, less so, but it's just what we do. It's hard to not take that in.
Yes. And so you are also an addiction researcher. What, from your research and from your experience, what would you recommend or what advice would you give to parents of teenagers?
First and foremost, it is really not about the food. Kind of worrying too much or being a little bit too involved in what they're eating or not eating, how much they're eating, is not generally helpful unless you already have someone who is, so far gone that they need medical intervention. That's a different story. But when I work with parents for just general well-being of their children and their families, first and foremost, I always tell them that the only person you can control is you. And there really isn't any need or desire to be controlling your child. And parents get the opposite message all the time. Parent this way, parent that way. It's like parenting is a verb. Parenting is not a verb. It's not something we do. It's a relationship. It's a relationship we have. But, and I have, you know, the utmost compassion for all parents out there. I have two kids, and it's really hard to not put our own stuff on our kids. It's really hard not to do that. So it's really about the parent doing their own personal work, looking at what are my beliefs, what are my fears, am I transmitting that to my children? Am I worried that they are going to follow in this way? Or so those are things. And then the number one thing is love your children unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And I know that we all do. Of course we do. But sometimes it doesn't come across that way, because even with our best intentions, we put conditions on our kids. Every time we praise our kids for the A they brought home, for the home run they hit, or I'm so proud of you, how you played in that game. Again, it's that double-edged messaging, which is, I wouldn't have been proud of you if you hadn't played that well. We don't mean that, and we don't mean that message, but it's being received. So as we sort of make all these conditions on our kids, that's where we're feeding their anxieties. That's where we're externalizing their worth. And it's, again, it's insidious, and parents are very well-meaning. Why can't I praise my kids? Well, you can, but just be aware that if I'm speaking somewhat from personal experience, one of my strengths as a kid was I was really good at school, and I derived a lot of self-esteem from that. And you know, my parents loved that I got A's, and they were always telling me how smart I was and great. Well, that's a lot of pressure, because if that's where my worth comes from, then I can never fail. I can never get a B, right? So, and we don't want that for our kids. We love our kids no matter what. And we want the best for them too.
Mm-hmm. I want to share with the audience, you said that we need, as parents, need to love our children unconditionally. Mm-hmm. So I just want to share what that means. The term love unconditionally means acceptance without mm-hmm. judgment. And I think I just want you guys to hear that's, you know, we can love somebody, but when we love them unconditionally, it's acceptance without judgment. And that's a very important spiritual concept that both Susan and I have learned on the journey. I know in my journey, I went to a psychologist to learn how to speak to my children about food, because boy, was I worried. And mm-hmm. even though I was still in addiction and not in recovery, I didn't know how to talk to them about food. I didn't know how to help them to learn to eat in a healthy way, but not be too restrictive. But one of the things I think that's important, and you alluded to this with the parents, it's really about embracing self-love, both for yes. the parent and the child. And so what are your thoughts on that? Like, how do we enable people to love themselves unconditionally?
Oh, if I knew the answer entirely, I would love to say it. But I do help people with this. And I think there's a few different ways. One is there are certain skills that can be learned. Okay. So self-compassion is a skill. In fact, most of us, being compassionate to others comes naturally. It's sort of inborn. But being compassionate to ourselves does not come quite as naturally. In fact, most of us are more compassionate to others than we are. We're very critical, self-critical. But it's a skill. And it's something that can be learned and it can be practiced. And so that is in a lot of the work that I do is take people through various practices and exercises to sort of work that muscle a little bit. And that's not exactly the same as self-love, but it's getting closer. Yeah. It's
getting warmer.
Yes. For me, I know that part of my recovery and a different outlook I have now on life is just seeing how interconnected we are. And I think this is more of the spiritual aspect of I am worthy just because I am. There's nothing that I have to do or be or look like, you know, those are optional. And it's, I don't know how necessarily to get someone else to recognize that, but that is sort of the key, is to remember that, because we forgot.
And I would add to that, when you know that you're connected, interconnected, you open the door for grace to come into your life, to help you with whatever is bothering you. And so when you know that you are part of this divine human world that we live in, then grace is, because grace is always available to us 24 hours a day. We just don't sometimes recognize it. So the more you understand and the more you focus on your spiritual path or your religious path, I think the more that grace becomes readily apparent to you. So we're going into another break now. Thank you for listening to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and my guest, Dr. Susan Averna. We'll be right back.
Ascending with the Octurians with Vivian Chouvette. Tune in to Transformation Talk Radio every second and fourth Fridays at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We are shifting from this third dimensional plane of reality to higher octaves of life. Let us reclaim our sovereignty as a united family of light and manifest the planetary ascension, our return to Prime Creator. For information on our services and to connect with Vivian, visit infinitehealingfromthestars.com.
Imagine you are a ball of steel, smooth, small, and cool to the touch. Your life will soften you with fire. You will take hits that shape you. You will be forged into a powerful, purposeful work of art. Tune in to Forging a Life with Coach Christine Clark, joining Dr. Pat Basile in a three-part series, Truths in the Creation of Katana, on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Christine Clark, a gifted, engaging speaker and trainer who has forged her life in the fires of self-employment, will take you on a journey to exploring the internal, mental, and emotional blocks that stand between us and a life of significance through an analogy of the process of crafting a traditional Japanese sword, or katana. For more information about Christine, visit sunglowtransformation.com.
You're driven, and it totally shows. Your career is taking off, you're killing it in the mom game. But did your health needs make it on the plate this week? Tune in to the Boss Up Babe radio show, where Carissa Adkins helps babes show up, boss up, and thrive. Every second and fourth Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Become the boss babe you were meant to be. To sign up for one of Carissa's group coaching programs, visit 365dailyhustle.com.
Welcome back to Hungry for Answers with me, Robin Clare, and my guest, Dr. Susan Averna. So when we went to break, Susan reminded me that I asked a question, but we didn't get to answer it, which was, how do you recognize food disorders in others?
Right. So in addition to noticing someone who's restricting food, or maybe appears to be binging or very secretive about food, those are some of the obvious food-related things. You would also maybe notice weight fluctuation, which of course doesn't necessarily mean eating disorder. That could mean lots of things, but it could be a red flag, or a loss of weight. Sometimes people will wear very baggy clothes to hide extreme weight loss, that kind of thing. But then other signs to look for that could be related. And again, maybe not specific to this, but just to let you sort of pay attention, is depression or depressive symptoms, an increase in anxiety, isolation. If, for instance, we're talking about children or adolescents, you know, are they pulling away from friends? Are they not engaging in the same way? So all of these things could be symptoms of a lot of things. It could be just depression or anxiety, but it's worth noticing the bigger picture.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. I think Another thing you might notice is someone gaining weight.
Yes.
Because one of the things that people misunderstand is that they think that bulimia is a form of, as a weight loss tool. In fact, it's the opposite. Your body goes into starvation mode and it holds on to every calorie that it can.
Right.
And therefore, you're most likely, if you're bulimic, to be carrying around an extra 20, 30, 40 pounds because your body is saying, I'm not going to burn calories. What are you kidding? I don't trust her or him. I don't think that they're going to hold on to the food.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that would be true for binge eating disorder as well. And probably even more true is when someone is binging as a form of self-soothing and regulation that they obviously would gain weight over time. So yes, rapid weight gain. So again, none of these are indicative necessarily, but just all red flags to keep mm-hmm. in mind.
So what type of therapies would you recommend for someone or parents that are looking to help their children with food addiction or food disorders?
So because it's so multifactorial, I feel like there's a lot of aspects to the recovery and to the therapy. And the field of psychology is actually really embracing more body-based therapies now, which is great. That's really come out of the trauma work. Talk therapies can still be very effective. And there are certain types of talk therapies that might get at certain aspects of this disorder. So for instance, cognitive behavioral therapies are very good at addressing the cognitive distortions. That said, there people who are eating disordered are very resistant to changing those beliefs. It's not as simple as that. And I think that alone would not be enough to really change course. I am a huge fan of body-based therapies. So for example, and there's a lot of them out there now, but Peter Levine's work, Somatic Experiencing, Pat Ogden's work, and I'm blanking on the name of hers at the moment. And I actually, as a yoga teacher, there's a lot of yoga therapies that are aimed at getting the person to befriend their body, to become more attuned and in touch with their bodies. Because when we engage in these behaviors, we're really separating ourselves. We stop listening to the cues. We don't even remember how anymore. And so when I say yoga, I don't mean just go out to your yoga class and do a vinyasa hot yoga class. And in fact, some of what we call yoga here in the US would be probably harmful because it's too externalized and mm-hmm. how do I look in my yoga pants kind of thing. I'm talking about really going to a class where the compassion is nurtured, where self-inquiry is nurtured, where you have the space to be with the sensations in your body and notice them. Mindfulness practices and meditation can do the same thing, although they can be intolerable for someone as a first step, but you might be able to get there after doing some mindful movement and really paying attention to your body. And because those are all the skills that you're eventually going to build and use to replace the behaviors that are not so adaptive anymore, like the binging, like the restricting and all of that, and being able to meet the need. You can't meet your need until you know what that is. And you can't know what right. that is without these self-awareness skills.
And self-awareness and having a relationship with your body,
absolutely.
Even if at the beginning it's coming from a place of anger or disappointment, mm-hmm. you cannot get better without acceptance of your body in whatever state it's in. So when we meet again on July 15th, we'll be diving much more into these therapies and into all of this. We're going to go like a whole different level deeper because that's why. Because I think that this is a topic that deserves. Two episodes, and I not only because, as I said, it's what brought me to Hungry for Answers, but it's also affecting so many millions of people, 30 million people in the United States. So we talked a little bit about grace, and so the idea of grace. We need grace in our lives. Meaning that we need to be able to know, we need to be able to get to the answers for ourselves. And grace comes in the form of when you surrender your problem to your divine source, grace will arrive in the form of people to connect with, ideas for how to get better. And so, you know, we're hopefully over these two episodes having you come into a place of helping you to figure out how to come into a place of surrender so that you can get well in your own life. And so I also want to, for just 1 minute, if you could tell us about Witness and Wonder, your business.
Yes, absolutely. So for about a decade now, I've been helping people with their personal development and sort of bridging this idea of trauma treatment with wellness practices, because they really are just two sides of the same coin. And I've worked with a lot of different populations. I've worked with teens and young adults, college students, medical students, parents, educators, and I really wanted to bring it under one umbrella. And so what I do is I give talks, I do consultations with schools, for instance, and I love to run groups, small, intimate groups, but groups nonetheless, because I think there's a dynamic to a group that's really helpful in healing. But basically the crux is to get these skills to become more self-aware and self-reflective and self-compassionate. And it's those skills together. And that is why I called it Witness and Wonder. It was, can you bear witness to what is without judgment? And can you stay in a place of curiosity and wonder and not, you know, jump to conclusions or assumptions or judgment? And so that's what it's me leading people on developing these skills for themselves so that they can have some internal resilience and also improve their relationships.
Yes, I love all of that. I love the name, very good from a marketing perspective, because it is what it is, right? It's we are the witness to our own life. You know, we're a witness to what our soul wants to accomplish in this lifetime. And no doubt that, you know, our divine source wants us to be happy and joyful, not filled with pain. And so when we can stay open to the wonder, the magic of life, I call my life the magical mystical tour. I'm open to the magic and I'm open to the mysteries that will unfold. And so we're coming to the end of the program. And I just want to say to our listeners, if you're suffering or struggling with addiction, please know that healing, recovery, and living of your ultimate life is available to you. Please look for professional people to help you or to go inside and connect with your own spiritual guidance. As a writing coach, I help people that are in recovery who want to share their story to help heal others. And you can sign up for a free 30-minute consultation with me at www.clarity.com. And thank you, Dr. Susan Averna, for a wonderful segment. And I'll see you back here for July 15 to continue the conversation on food disorders, the hidden epidemic. So until then, or until the next time I'm on, which will be before July 15, I will see you all then. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into Hungry for Answers. Learning to love ourselves is the one true solution to addiction. Make a commitment to healing today and see how you can reach your ultimate potential. Remember, you have a divine right to a life filled with love, joy, peace, and abundance. To learn more about me and my offerings, please go to clarity.com. That's Claire, C-L-A-R-E, -ity.com. See you next time.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.